CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby, BC, striving to provide points of view that are rarely expressed in mainstream media.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Hale, and with me, as so often, is Brandon.
I'm looking forward to discussing Montaigne and his essays. Well, you've been reading through his collections, but we've kind of selected two in particular that we thought we would bring to the table to discuss, not just in terms of discussing the essays and getting into their content, but if you know and have been listening to the show, you know that Hale and I, we kind of like to look at not just the content, but the media which the content is served in. And so I think today we're going to look a little bit at Montaigne's essays generally. Yes, obviously we're going to talk about two of probably his most well-known essays, I think, especially within philosophy, but also kind of going into what Montaigne is doing when he's writing essays, what that's doing in the time that he's writing these essays in, because this is a new kind of format that obviously has precedence in other writers, even classical writers, but he's doing something new.
He is a French early modern philosopher from the 16th century. He's someone who, if you are into philosophy, you'll likely have heard of, but he's not like one of the big people. But he's nonetheless a really important philosopher and someone who was very, very influential in his own time and the preceding modern period. And as Brandon kind of hinted at there, he was important and really influential for his philosophical work on some level, but perhaps even more so for the forms that he created and popularized within philosophy that really became the mainstay of how we still do philosophy today, which is the essay. And I know that sounds kind of like probably some listeners are like, what do you mean, like the essay? And it's like more, it's generally regarded that Montaigne invented the modern essay. We're going to get way more into that. That's like a huge part of this show. We picked Montaigne because on the one hand, he's an interesting guy. He's a great writer. Well, Montaigne is a great example of looking at someone through the lens of a little bit of media theory from a long time ago, from 500 years ago now, almost at this point. So before we get into all that kind of stuff, though, it's probably worthwhile to talk a little bit about Montaigne himself, and then also talk a little bit about the era and world that he's coming from, because it's a really interesting time period, and he's quite an interesting guy. So to jump right into it with Montaigne himself, he was a kind of new aristocrat type guy in the 16th century. I don't have his birth and death dates right in front of me. I could look them up for you, but honestly, you all have the power of Google. You can do it. Maybe Brandon's doing it right now. But he was born in kind of the earlier mid-1500s, and he died, I think, in 1592 or something like that. When I say he was a new aristocrat, a little bit of his family background is that basically his grandfather to his father to him was sort of a proceeding of stepping stones of kind of moving up in the world. If I remember correctly, his grandfather had some estates that he kind of grew, and then his father took those over, and his father was quite a successful soldier for the French crown and stuff like that. And that really got him more status. And his father actually purchased royal titles, aristocratic titles for his family. So this was an era where, you know, if you had money, if you were a successful business person, a kind of early bourgeois, for lack of a better way of saying it, you could purchase, you know, noble titles. And his father did that. And his father was apparently not a learned man, but because he knew that the family and the situation was moving up in the world, he felt it was very important for Montaigne as a young man to be very well educated. And so Montaigne had quite an extensive and experimental upbringing. He was actually, as a young child, was sent to live with peasants, even though his family was extremely wealthy. They lived in the south of France on huge estates and, you know, in a big kind of classic chateau and all those sorts of stuff. You can think kind of like, you know, Louis the 16th or whatever, you know, in the Sun King and all that kind of stuff. But he was sent to live with peasants at one point as a young child to learn kind of how to be hardy and all those sorts of stuff. He was also wet nursed, as far as I know, which was a thing that people used to do back in the day. But then he was also too, he was, you know, I believe when he was quite young, he was given a tutor who did not speak French, but spoke Latin. And he basically exclusively spoke Latin. Like, he was basically forced to exclusively speak Latin. And this is because, this is a really important part of this episode for listeners, was because Montaigne grew up in the early modern period. He grew up in the Renaissance. He was a Renaissance man. And Latin was really important because Latin was the language that people used to access the ancients. And this is the big part of Montaigne. Basically, his whole philosophy, more or less, is a reflection, one might even say a regurgitation, of ancient philosophers. He was someone who held them in great esteem, and a lot of his works are more or less reflections and responses and discussions to all sorts of ancient thinkers, philosophers, historians, poets, particularly from the kind of Hellenistic to Roman period, what we call the classic ancient world. We're gonna get a lot more into that because it's a really huge important part of Montaigne. But to kind of wrap up his personal story a little bit more, he ended up fighting in a number of wars. He lived during the French Wars of Religion. So another aspect of the time world that he lived in was he lived basically during the Reformation, during the split up of Christianity in Western Europe. Between various forms of Protestantism and the Catholic Church, which degenerated into all sorts of, many times, very bloody and verging on genocidal-esque conflicts that happened throughout Europe. And he specifically fought for the royal side in those conflicts. And, you know, like so many of these sorts of kind of basically civil wars or wars of religion, his own family was split up between this. He remained a Catholic, although we'll get into it. He didn't seem to be a particularly religious person later in life. But many, many members of his family were Protestants. They became Protestants and it split the family apart. And just like the country was split apart, his own family was split apart and conflict and all this kind of stuff. So he fought in many wars. And then after his time as a soldier, he ended up becoming quite a high-level magistrate within the French royal court. So he was someone who spent a lot of time with kings. He was a diplomat. He was kind of a lawyer, which had a lot of influence on him. He traveled around quite a bit to different courts to be representatives for the King of France. He spent a lot of time with the King of France, King of Navarre. At the time, so he was a very well connected, very aristocratic, very wealthy, very learned guy. There's no other way to put it. You know, he was kind of an upper echelon of society type dude. And what kind of famously with his philosophy, what happened was later in his life, he had a friend he had a very close friend whose name I'm going to butcher for sure, by the name of Étienne de La Boétie. And de Boétie was another kind of aristocratic lawyer type guy who was actually interestingly enough, a very radical thinker. Many, many people consider him to be the first anarchist. He wrote a very early text on the legitimacy of political and social authority, in which he argued that political and social authority is never actually legitimate, and that it's always coercive, and that whether it's a king or an elected official or whoever it might be, that these, or a tyrant or whatever, these people never actually have legitimate standing. It was considered a subversive text. It was banned by the French royal court and the Catholic Church and stuff like that. But this was his best friend and his interlocutor through his kind of like early, like kind of mid-early life. And when that individual died, Montaigne was very lost, because this was kind of his main guy that he would talk to. And he ended up spending the rest of his life more or less around his great estates, kind of sequestered away a little bit, writing as if he was still in conversation with his close friend, is what many kind of scholars now believe. And I think in many places he kind of like admits or talks about because he lost his friend, he decided to start having basically all his ideas. He would compile them and sort of just continually work through very specific topics that were of interest to him. He wrote on a very wide range of subjects. And that's kind of where we, in that sort of tragedy and that sort of longing and him kind of coping with that, we end up getting this new form of conveying information that we now call the essay.
One really important step is that there was a sort of live dialogue going on between Michel de Montaigne and Étienne de la Potier. Then one of the parts steps away. Étienne passes away. But the dialogue continues, right? And it continues in the form of writing. Now, what's really interesting is that we've seen that before, right? We have a precedent for that in the history of philosophy, the Socratic dialogues. It's not as if this is a sort of new technique. Like the other thing that also jumps to my mind is Dante, how Beatrice dies and then Dante writes, you know, this epic, this three-part epic, the Divine Comedy. But it's in search of lost love. Here, this is in search of lost friendship. With Plato, maybe it was in search of lost mentorship, or maybe even, yeah. But in any case, it's interesting that de Montaigne has, the way that it issues is not through an actual dialogue, in terms of Plato, you know, like a back and forth where he is sort of using his mentor Socrates as like a mouthpiece, but he's still, de Montaigne is still treating the topics that they would have talked about, giving his side, weighing it, maybe doing what he would have always been doing with Etienne anyway, just kind of thinking things through and then presenting them to him. But I just noticed this because the sort of dialogicality of it, the dialectical relationship is really apparent.
It's an interesting note that, you know, in all these sorts of cases, the formation of a kind of new type of medium, we might say, was sort of precipitated by death, by loss, and someone trying to, which also effectively presents someone with, you know, we have the notion of interlocutor, whether that be as a lover, as a friend, as a teacher and student, as, you know, Plato and Socrates or many others. And then, you know, a great mind is, for lack of a better way of saying it, or an inventive mind is faced with trying to replicate that. Now that the circumstances are different, you know, how can I continue on with this process as best I can? And in that process, in that kind of, you know, in that sort of like pressure cooker, for like what I was saying it, you know, something new is formed, right? Now, you know, with Plato, you get the philosophical dialogues, which, you know, I think it's debatable whether or not he invented the philosophical dialogue, but he certainly perfected and popularized that. Well, there's no question about that. And with Montaigne, what we get is the essay. And it sounds strange because, you know, how could the essay be like a new thing, right? Now, interestingly, there's a couple different ways to translate or interpret the term essay. One that I heard in doing research for this episode for our listeners was an attempt. So essay means an attempt. An attempt at what? An attempt at explaining or looking into some very specific subject matter, right? So I think it's worthwhile for a moment talking about, like, okay, well, how could that have been invented? It's important to think about what people were doing before. Prior to like the essay as a popular form, you had treatises, which were obviously like long works, right? We had dialogues, what we talked about before. The one, so I'm sorry for this, so a treaty would be something like, you know, I'm trying to think what would be a famous treaty that's that some of our listeners would be familiar with.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because for this, you would have to go into like, either you would have to find like an ancient treatise. So maybe something like Cicero's works, you know, on friendship, on duties, stuff like that. But those are not exactly essays. Those are treatises, right? He is taking a subject, and as the skillful orator that Cicero is, he is sort of ranging over the topic. Where he's not really, I mean, he is obviously making some kind of attempt to make a statement or state some opinion about it. Because rhetoric is very good at sort of exhaustively treating something, I don't know if the treatise has the kind of specificity that the essay has. Like, the essay has, the essay doesn't really pretend to exhaustively treat something. So, like, for example, with Montaigne's essay on friendship, it's not a philosophical explication of friendship per se. He has one very specific thing he wants to try to say about friendship, and he makes that attempt in the kind of stating of an opinion, maybe something else coming up, or citing, you know, the ancients to back him up, or even maybe to refute him. But in any case, the treatise is much more broad, and it attempts a kind of, it doesn't attempt the specificity that an essay does.
Yeah, I think a great example of a treatise, you know, some might debate this, but sort of what we're getting at, would be actually St. Thomas Aquinas's, like something like the Summa Theologica, where, you know, we're presenting a very, you know, this is a very expansive, very broad, very expansive, very, it's a very thick book. And it's, you know, in the case of Thomas Aquinas, it's, you know, building a sort of Christian metaphysics and, you know, and from that, a physics, ethics, all these sorts of things, right? That sort of expand out in a full theory.
Yeah, it aspires to be exhaustive, the Summa. It's the sum. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the sum of all theology. And so we have treaties already. Those are around for quite a while. Okay, so we have dialogues. Probably the most interesting and the sort of proto-essay is letters. Letters. And what do we mean by letters? You know, I know, like, most of us think now about, you know, you write a letter conveying information to your friend or whatever, or now you write like an email or whatever. But back in the ancient world in particular, letters were, especially for learned people, were a way for them to sort of convey to a specific group, usually a group at distance, their ideas. So we'll talk quite a bit about Seneca probably a little bit in this episode, but another great example, a Christian example, would be Paul, the Apostle Paul. That many of our listeners would probably, I would hope, would be familiar with the Apostle Paul, you know, one of the you know, the great early apostles, and one of the kind of, you know, the sort of earliest formers of the Christian church. And it's in the first century AD, after, you know, after the death of Christ. And many of Paul's letters survive and were included in the Bible, and they are Paul responding to specific theological issues at a specific location. So, for example, like letter to the Corinthians, right? He's sending a letter to a specific church group in a specific area and basically saying, okay, you guys have issues A, B, C, D. These are my thoughts on those issues. It's relatively short. It's relatively concise. And it's relatively focused. And so in that sense, the ancient letter sort of becomes the proto essay.
Like a proto-essayist would be Plutarch and his Moralia, mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Because they're very specific and they address specific moral topics, you know. There's even one, it's quite short, and it's just like addressing the Epicure. I think it was the Stoic advice. No, was it Epic or Stoic, you know, Lethe Biosis, live in hiding. And he's just kind of like knocking this down. It's like very specific. It's very short. And he's talking about his own opinions. It's not necessarily an essay because it's not dialogical in the same way that De Montaigne is being dialogical, but it's the sort of proto essay for its specificity. Now, talking about letters and the role of Latin there's a great book if you're interested in media studies and media theory, and it's just like every page is just like something great. It's Walter Ong's Literacy and Orality, and he talks about the invention, not the invention of Latin, but essentially the reinstatement of Latin the way that he puts it, it's like if you were to learn Latin in this time period, it's like getting internet access, because now you transcend your regional dialect, which your local dialect at the time would have only been spoken by the people in a 10-mile radius. When you learn Latin, you learn a universal language. It's necessary for going to the universities. And now you can write letters. Now you can write letters to everyone. It's essentially, it's internet access. Spinoza talks about how incredible it was to have learned Latin, because now he can communicate with all these people across Europe. So the other important thing, too, that I wanted to bring up with De Montaigne specifically is that for the Latinates who are learning Latin in medieval and, you know, early modern Europe, Latin is always a second language, right? It's something you learn after the fact. So it's artificial. It's very artificial. The vocabulary is liable to change with technical needs of the speakers. And it has that kind of calcified secondary process to it, if we want to use like a Freudian term. For De Montaigne, the other thing too is like, let's center this really quickly. Latin is internet access. It opens up things. You're supposed to feel connected once you learn Latin. I don't remember where exactly I heard this statement, but De Montaigne's kind of experimental upbringing is really interesting, because he learns Latin from a young age, right? It's kind of a first language for him. So he isn't experiencing that same kind of like opening up to the, the university students, this European culture of the world of letters, you know? And I remember hearing that it must have been like very lonely for De Montaigne to be this kind of like native tongue Latin speaker, having, you know, conversing himself with the ancients, sure, but it's not the same thing as this sort of connection with Europe. It's just if we're bringing up sort of elements that might introduce something new into the picture that Montaigne is doing, he's breaking with this tradition of the university students taking on Latin to be able to communicate with Europeans in this sort of media form of it being a secondary language.
Yeah, and I think, it's interesting looking at Montaigne's, primary work, the essays, and I don't speak or read Latin or early modern French, but I know from the annotations of the work that I have, the translation that I have, that there's almost as much Latin in his work as there is French. So that's how well versed he was in Latin. He was completely, inundated in speaking and reading Latin and all that. And I think it's worthwhile now talking a little bit about like why in De Montaigne's world as this philosophical. I'd like to say that in many ways, like, you and I were talking before the show a little bit about Montaigne himself, and there's a lot of elements to Montaigne's story that are very interesting. His actual philosophical work, our listeners should know, he never really considered himself a philosopher. And reading him is almost like you're more like reading a very gifted student. And what he's a student of is the ancient world, is ancient thought, basically. And that is because Montaigne, as we kind of mentioned earlier, is in this early modern period. He is a Renaissance guy, and a huge aspect of the Renaissance's relationship to basically media, to literature, to ideas and thought, is not looking around at one's own time and ideas that are coming, but instead hearkening back and looking backwards to the ancient world for legitimacy, right? Like, that's where authoritative texts come from. That's where real knowledge comes from. That's where great ideas come from. They come from, in Montaigne's case, like an eon or more before. Basically, before the Roman Empire, back to Hellenistic Greece, these are the people that if you are a intellectual in Montaigne's era, that you need to be interested in.
Yeah. Yeah, there's this idea. I mean, I'm not a Renaissance scholar, but the more that I, or the very little that I have encountered with this, it's, I mean, I guess this is true with any good scholarship. It's all very inspiring and a very... It makes the texts that they are talking about very alluring. But the Renaissance specifically is interesting because the ideas forming at the time are in response to the political divisions that are arising specifically in Italy. So it is... The idea of the Renaissance essentially, to give the very crude... I heard this through a wall, essentially, story. The Renaissance, or at least the idea of the Renaissance man, starts with Petrarch, who looks around at the Italian feuds going on and sees so much violence and so much disunity. But he's also looking to the past and seeing the unity of the Roman Empire. And he's saying, you know, if we just had their books, if we just raised ourselves on their culture, if we encountered their ideas, if we really imbibed what the Romans had, well, we could have the Roman Empire. We could have working infrastructure. We could have safe roads, essentially, for travel. We could communicate with each other again. And so he wants to install this idea of the universal sort of student, the widely learned humanist, the liberal thinker. And this inspires the project of raising Montaigne. Just another kind of parallel as well. I've always kind of, in hearing Montaigne's upbringing, I've always thought of it like John Stuart Mill as well, who I think was always kind of inspired, or his upbringing was kind of inspired by the same ideal of, well, if we could just raise a noble soul, then they would go out and propagate the right kind of, they'd actually be able to make the right kinds of changes in the world. They might be able to right some wrongs with their intellectual virtues. Montaigne is the same, or he's essentially trying to be raised out of this Petrarchian ideal of the humanist who has taken in the virtues of the past and can cash that out into effective policy or clear insights.
And yeah, and you used a term there that I think is essential. Like, I completely agree with you. And I think it's essential for this, you know, Montaigne's project and understanding him, which is humanism, right? You know, this sort of part of the rejection and sort of refocusing that goes on in the Renaissance period, and you see this in Montaigne, is, you know, the religious order that the Catholic religious order, the Orthodox religious order that had sort of, you know, been universal across Europe for about 1,000 years since the Council of Nicaea, more or less, with the formation, you know, the kind of, you know, officiating of the New Testament. And, you know, and the sort of like the officiating of the Catholic Church, and that sort of spreading out as a sort of like relatively cohesive, you know, intellectual and structural body that, you know, has both religious, spiritual context, but also has a great deal of political authority. And, you know, that system, because of the Reformation, you know, with Martin Luther and things happening in Germany, just, you know, a little bit before Montaigne's birth, or probably like a century or so. We say a little bit, but it was like 100 years. But yeah. In history, the farther you go back, the shorter everything gets, it seems. But ultimately, you know, this is broken down, right? Like you have the Reformation, you have the rise of Protestantism, as we